Now, last week on Wednesday, which we always have our conversation with the folks from the city paper, the mainstay of the paper in this week was about The Wire. It's the 13th anniversary of that production, which changed the nature of television in many ways, even though it never won an Emmy for any of its episodes. And it has been challenged in many ways over the years by some because of its depth in kind of looking at society like a place like Baltimore in ways other TV shows have not, as being a novel on television. Also has been criticized in many ways for not going deep enough and looking at the activists who take hold in the cities like Baltimore to fight back against that oppression. It was the TV show that had more black actors in it than any other TV show before or since, and provided a great deal of work. And it was an interesting program, but a lot of critique about it. So we're going to talk about that critique today with some of the people who have been writing about that in the city paper and a professor here at Morgan who appeared in The Wire. We're joined by Lawrence Grand Prix in the studio, Assistant Director of Research and Public Policy at Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, co-author with Dave Von Love of the Black Book, Reflecting from the Baltimore Grassroots, who wrote an article in the current issue of the city paper called Smile for the Camera, The Representational Limits of The Wire. Good to see you again in the studio, Lawrence.
Always good to be here.
And Dr. Kate Drabinski is in the studio, lecturer of gender at Gender and Women's Studies and director of the Women Involved in Learning and Leadership Program at UMBC, wrote an article in the city paper as well called Field Tripping, Biking the Wire. And good to have you back, Kate, in the studio.
Nice to see you.
Philip Burgess joins us by phone. He is a classically trained actor, theater lecturer here at Morgan, born and raised in the west side of Baltimore, and appeared in an episode of The Wire. Philip, good to have you with us as well.
Hey, how's it going?
Very well. And pretty soon, Dr. Lawrence Brown will be in studio to join us. He didn't write for this issue of the city paper, but he did write an incredibly interesting analysis of The Wire 2 years ago in the Indy Reader. And he'll be joining us here with his thoughts in just a few minutes. And you all can join us with your thoughts at 410-319-8888. Write to us here, talk@steinershow.org. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Log on to our Facebook pages. But do call in, 410-319-8888. So, The Wire. I mean, I've been thinking a great deal about this, and I read Dave Zirin's piece he wrote in The Nation just recently about it. As someone who was a big fan, let me also say that I appeared in a couple of episodes of The Wire as well, as a disclaimer. They had to be put that up front and out. So, you know, people don't think I'm being prejudicial about anything. Put it all on the table. And David and Simon and I are also friends. So I put that on the table as well. Let all that be said. And we've interviewed almost every actor on The Wire that passed through The Wire, all the writers, David Simon and many more, from Homicide all the way through The Wire and all those other series. So, but having said all that, let's talk about what in reflection after the 13th anniversary of the end of this program, what do we think is there and what do we think is missing?
Well, I think, you know, from an artistic perspective, I think that in a lot of ways art imitates life, and I think it was a great slice of that, actually, because it was inspired by, you know, real life events and real people. But, you know, the thing that happens when you try to translate, you know, art into real life is the representation doesn't always ring true. You know, as I was reading, you know, the articles, you know, in the city paper and the reference to the police images as, you know, almost being comical. Growing up in West Baltimore, I can actually identify with that. You know, growing up as a teenager, you know, and in the 80s, before, you know, the devastation of, you know, crack. You know, heroin was already there, but, you know, once crack hit West Baltimore, it devastated the city, and it drove me out, and driving me out, it saved my life. You know, and I found my path in life because
right.
I knew if I stayed there, you know, it would have gone in a different direction. But, you know, with that being said, I think that The Wire was a great representation of what Baltimore is or was. Now, speaking to the here and now, I think we're seeing the residual effects of The Wire, if that makes sense.
Lawrence Grand Prix?
You know,
yeah.
I wrote in my piece that I think The Wire was a great piece of art. And even though I'm critical of The Wire in many ways in terms of its political implications, I really mean that. I think of it this way. The Wire truly elevated what many people in Baltimore experience every day to a level of Greek tragedy. And in fact, at some moments, people on the show have said they use Greek tragedy as a framework for some of the dramatic framework of the show. But even just think about that phrase, Greek tragedy. So you have a Eurocentric intellectual framework that, according to Simon himself, is very pessimistic of all structures. And that's the framework transposed onto Baltimore. And I think that's really politically problematic. I say one thing that you don't see in the show is any inkling, semblance, anything of the Black Lives Matter movement. And that's one of the things I think is most emblematic of the political limitations of the show, because it's almost as if it's incapable of conceptualizing Black agency of the Black residents of Baltimore. And one example of this is in season one when D'Angelo is in the box confessing, and he says, "I feel like I can't breathe. The structural conditions of Baltimore have literally taken his breath away." So we have this vertiginous moment of conflict where the police, through the possibility of putting him in witness protection, can give him his breath back, can give him the possibility of a full and fulfilling life, when we know in reality it's the cops who are taking our breath away in terms of their relationship to structural violence and institutional racism. So I think that's just a clean example of the political limitations.
I thought it was a great show. I've also read all of David Simon's books, and I think he does something that a lot of, I remember reading The Corner, and it's a really long book, and reading through it, what I was struck by was the radically different realities that people who make decisions in Baltimore exist in and the people who live in Baltimore exist in. And it's what he's really good at making that argument. Part of me worries that The Wire is so good in terms of drama that people think watching the show means that they understand the depth of what's happening in Baltimore and the complexities of the histories here and the complexity of the lives that are lived here and the struggle that's happening. And one thing that I always had to be on guard against when watching The Wire was, it's so good, it's going to make me like the cops, you know? And I want to stay critically minded, but the show is so good at humanizing the different characters that you can almost forget, if you're not careful or you're not living in the place, you can almost forget that there are other people here too, right? And that there are complexities here, and that it doesn't matter how like funny Carver is, right? That he's part of a structure that is about violence. So I love the show. I have to stay critical of it, or I'm in danger of getting sucked into thinking that I understand something really deep from watching The Wire.
I guess I did also love The Wire. I mean, I thought that it opened with, let me just throw out kind of how I see this conception, and let's discuss and debate this. And folks joining in, because we've had you calling in over and over again about how much you love The Wire and hate The Wire and think it's it portrays Black folks in a negative, in a derisive way. Other people have very opposite feelings. Please join us. I want to hear your ideas at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@sanderson.org. But 410-319-8888. Because, all right, it was the first program, I thought, that really tried to get into an economic understanding of how the process of deindustrialization just destroyed this city and cities like it around America, and destroyed large segments of our population, driving people down, especially in the Black community and communities of color, and that reality. And so few people were even willing to tackle that at any level. On the other hand, there was no, when you used the word agency a moment ago, Lawrence Grand Prix, it was there were no parts of the piece that talked about movements of people trying to take the streets back and control their neighborhoods, control communities, and build a different life. That part was not in The Wire in any great depth. And also the issue of how brutal police can be on the streets was not part of that as well. All that, those are contradictions, but the power of it has unleashed all kinds of discussions as well. So, I mean, I'd like to kind of throw those out as a kind of thoughts to wrestle with here before we go to the phones.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point that it started conversations, right? That people weren't, you know, that a lot of people weren't having. I say people, but I think I mean like white people for whom this show was their first introduction to something complex about race and police relations in a post-industrial city, right? So I think it did start those conversations, but I'm not sure. I think that's great.
For me, it's a question of quantity of conversation versus quality of conversation. I do think this show proposes some possibilities for black agency, but I am very critical of the subtext of the way that agency is expressed. For example, you have a lot of black folks in the union, and union politics are complicated, but I just think the way I was watching the show, I had flashbacks of Hegel, where it was like the only way black folk can come into history is through something like a Eurocentric political framework like the union. And so I just think that it did a really disservice to the complexity of politics. And along with that, you have my critique of the way they framed Neiman Bryce, the son of Wiebe Bryce, being saved by an Urban Debate League, which as a product of the Urban Debate League and the debate coach, the representations behind what debate is and the notions of saving people through debate, I think it's really problematic because when we do debate, we have this very specific cultural framework that we use that we've gotten a lot of pushback on from the type of people who watch The Wire, who want our kids to debate like Neiman did in that debate. And our kids are rapping, they're talking about white supremacy, they may use a few choice words that have four letters, but that's the reality of the oppression they're facing. And you have people who saw The Wire and say, well, we can resolve these contradictions through things like conversation and dialogue within a traditional political framework. And it's like, no, we need to have a much more radical approach to politics because the reality of suffering is so deep. But The Wire is not interested in that. It's interested in having a pleasurable experience for its audience.
I concur with Davon saying, and
Lawrence,
and that,
right.
You know, the show The Wire is one show, and the challenge with that is you're picking and choosing, and they're telling a different story. There's so many other complexities that come with Baltimore City outside of what The Wire show, and in the picking and choosing of the schools versus City Hall versus the streets, you can only tell so many stories within so many cities. Within so many series, and with that challenge, the political agendas come into play. So what stories are the stories that are going to promote the agendas of the entertainment system? What is the most story that's most entertaining? It's not, as at the end of the day, it's not so much evoking change as it is entertaining.
Well, let me push back a little bit. I want to, and Lawrence Brown just joined the discussion. Good to have you in the studio, Lawrence. As always, we get that mic over to you so we can hear that voice. At 410-319-8888, Davey, the first caller up. But let me, a quick pushback before we go to the phones here. I guess I would push back a little bit. I don't want to get sidetracked on this idea, but by unions being Eurocentric, I mean, I think unions have been central to the struggle in this country to fight for workers' rights, human rights, whether it was garbage workers in Memphis, Tennessee, or the fact we had segregated unions in the city, but longshoremen as well, which was in this production. So David Simon did want to entertain anybody who makes anything in media, in theater, in film, wants to entertain. If you don't entertain, no one's going to watch it if they're not entertained by what they see.
Right.
Right? But I think that in his entertainment, he also tackled things that nobody else had yet on television. Yeah. In a way somebody had, though his essential analysis, part of the problem is, was pessimistic, that nothing can change the corrupt oligarchy, the corrupt nature of capitalism, that nothing can change that, and it's just a downward trend. It's all going to implode, explode.
Which, by the way, is a new narrative, huh? Right? I mean, most television shows are like, and then at the end of the day, you know, the white teacher moves into the inner city school, and then all the kids are saved and go to college, and they all go to Harvard, and they join the swim team, right? So it is, even that pessimism is itself a kind of new thing to see on TV. And I would just say that there is not a single narrative that can capture all of the stories and all the complexity, right? That desire for that kind of narrative is itself a kind of colonial desire of, like, universalism.
Why don't you weigh in, then we'll get to the phone.
Sure. I was listening to what Lawrence Grant Peace said earlier about the Greek tragedy part, and I think he's absolutely right about that, because what you see in The Wire is sort of this view of the individual –
That's
this lone wolf that's always trying to attack an institution and always fails. And I think an Afrocentric view, I am because we are, is much more collective. And that's why he misses the power or the ability of groups to come together to change the system. So I do think that there's absolute legitimacy to that point. I do think what he gets right, though, is like, what happens to men who lose work? Mm-hmm. Because he looks at the drug organization in season one and then the Sabacas, the union, in season two. And I think this really powerful examination of across racial lines, what happens to white men and black men when they lose work in Baltimore. And I think that's really powerful, because what he does is, I think he tries to situate it within a critique of capitalism vis-a-vis post-industrialization. And I think he tries to have this sustained critique of the war on drugs. But I think what he does miss in that policy sort of arena is the impact and the legacy of American segregation. He misses racial zoning, racially restrictive covenants. He misses redlining. So he misses, like, the way that American racism helped structure the communities in which people right. live. And so that ends up being, he ends up tilting heavily towards this economic analysis, but he's totally oblivious, I think, to the racial analysis.
In some way, I would have to disagree with that statement in the way that, and that the character that I played the security guard that was put in the vacancy by Marlo. Now, if you listen to his lines, he said, "You think I had a dream of coming up in this crap on a Sunday morning, tell all my friends what a good job I got? I'm working to support a family, man." And he is being oppressed by the very person that should or could be giving him a hand up, which is Marlo. But because Marlo lost $50,000 in a poker game and was being emasculated in that game, he had to then give it back to the working man, to the man that was trying to support a family at minimum wage, if that makes sense. So, I mean, I think they did a really a good job of showing the complexities of the struggles of the working man, both black and white, because when they took it to the docks, they told that struggle as well.
And I think that one of the things that Lawrence, very quickly before we go to break here, and we're going to go to break in 30 seconds, when we come back we'll wrestle with this, is, I mean, I think that he did get class, and he brought class into it in a way that no other TV show has ever brought class into it.
Yes.
But he did miss, I think, in some ways, the kind of the extreme racism of a community like Baltimore, of this country, what it's done and why these conditions exist, because that's one of the reasons you didn't see the overt brutality by police that you often see in the streets. And so I think that was a huge missing component of this, as well as the collective, the nature of things. But let's go to
maybe a thing or two about gender. Well, there's a lot about masculinity, but there are women in Baltimore too. That's all. I know we have to go.
No, we should talk about that. Yeah. Women in the wires is another subject that needs to be wrestled with. 410-319-8888. Dave, you're the first caller up. We're going to come right back. Stay with us. Umbrella, Rihanna, hit number one on this day in 2007 on a way to break. I didn't tell you what we listened to. It was a theme for The Wire, but performed by Black Star and MIA. And we're here with our guests, Dr. Lawrence Brown, Dr. Kate Trubinsky, Philip Burgess, and Lawrence Grand Prix. And you at 410-319-8888. Lawrence, before we jump to you, let me grace the phones, as I promised. And Dave in Baltimore, you're on the air. Welcome. Hi, Dave. You there?
Can you hear me?
I can.
Hi. The Wire, oh, what poetry. It is, Mark, it is what it is. I see the problem for the artist to make sexy and exciting the positive. How can we assign David Simon to do a show on, let's say, a feisty prosecutor who stands up to FOP, or maybe a revolutionary nonviolent group that has solutions? How? Nobody does it.
Dave, I think that's one of the things that Lawrence kind of touched on a little bit. The Grand Prix, there are two Lawrences here, right? that the battle to change society, which is usually a collective battle, not a battle of an individual that makes things change, even though we put individuals at the head of them, that's part of what we don't see because of the pessimistic nature of the series, I think.
Yeah. And I think it's because of the historiography of the series, honestly, because I think it's inexcusable that you do a show about Baltimore for five seasons and don't even mention slavery. And sometimes we at LBS talk about the importance of white supremacy, contextualizing how we understand things even like gender. That's not to say that race is more important than gender, but we have a structure, a historical structure that contextualizes how these things manifest themselves. So you can't understand masculinity without understanding things like slavery. And so you have black men who get emasculated because their only models for masculinity are white American forms of masculinity that were largely formed by slavery. And then you have people like Kima, who is played by the brilliant Sonya Stone, who we have a good relationship with at LBS, who is in a masculine institution, who is trying to resist it, but also sometimes get caught up in the culture of masculinity in the police department. And all I'm saying is that it may be useful to understand the historiography of things like gender and the race and slavery to understand that.
Let me ask three of this quick question, and then we'll go to Betty, our next caller up. But so let's take what you just said, Lawrence. Let's just play with this for like 5 minutes and play with this for a moment. So how would you have done that? How would you have taken, without being pedantic, and brought that creatively into a script?
Selma did it. You know, Selma showed a collective group in action. And admittedly, that was about a collective story. But surely he could have struck a balance. I mean, if Selma's at the other extreme of a collective group fighting oppression, then he could have, you know, shown three or four people coming together, you know, because it was always a lone wolf. It was always like one person trying to challenge a great institution, and they inevitably fail every single time in The Wire, except maybe Bubbles, who sort of changes his life at the end. But other than that, I mean, and he's changing his own life, not challenging an institution. So I think that's the thing that I think he could have. I mean, something could have been done, and that isn't to say that The Wire isn't a great show. But it is to say that the power of collective action is completely missing.
So when they're blowing up the towers, I would have some character remark on how the very spot where the towers are is where one of the three most active slave trading ports on the East Coast after the end of the Atlantic slave trade. Like, that was one of the, like, that site of public housing was also the very site of massive slave trading in Baltimore City. And also would have done a storyline about public housing and the women who organized because public housing isn't bad because it's bad, right? Like, it's made bad, right? And people have organized to make it a good place. And public housing initially in Baltimore City was for white people. It was a place that was an honor to live, right? Mm-hmm. So doing a little bit of so yeah, he can't do everything. But if I'm going to write the show, I would have a whole storyline about the women who organized in public housing and those collective actions that, you know, the government said, okay, you need to get people involved on these public review boards. And then they just took those public review boards and they really organized exciting, interesting, cooperative movements. And I would have had a storyline about that. And I would have, in the show, would have had references to the history of slavery and in Baltimore City, even though I would not have been pedantic about it.
No, I like that, Kate. And come right back to Grand Prix. Maybe I should use last names here to make sure which Lawrence we're talking to. Because I think that you can make an interesting storyline. When you said that, what popped in my head was you have the Marlowes and the drug dealers doing their thing, which they do every day, and the violence that occurs, the police doing what they do. But if there had been a third element there, which would have been people like you're describing, people taking on the community to take it back, to control, to stop the violence by the police, to stop the violence in the community, to create a new community. I mean, that would have been another element that could have been an explosive inside what could still have been a great drama.
I just want to go real quickly. One of my favorite sayings is that racism, white supremacy takes simple things and turns them into rocket science. Like, I know it's hard artistically, but if you just study the history, there are all types of moments of possibilities. For example, when the character goes to the Eastern Shore, you could talk about maroon communities. He's with his grandmother. His grandmother could have a cultural relationship descending from slavery. When you have the row homes, some of these row homes are former servants' quarters that link back to slavery. That magnifies the drama of people being locked locked into row homes. And finally, when you have something like Cuddy, some of the most successful programs I've seen in Baltimore are things like rites of passage programs that link a cultural history extending from slavery. And that's how people genuinely get saved in Black Baltimore, not through things like, you know, what The Wire talks about. But what do we get? We get the mayor dressed in kente cloth, basically tricking people with sort of simplistic racial analysis. So I think, he needs to study the history, and I just don't see that in The Wire.
Yeah, I wanted to make mention to that as well. I think that was the missing component of the teaching of the different cultures that make Baltimore what it is. I mean, the fact that I grew up in a culture that had a thriving recreation system, recreation and park system, and the fact that when I was in school, we went on field trips, and that's where I learned the culture of acting and theater, and we miss, they miss that, I think, because that's what makes Baltimoreans who they are, and I think it was a huge gap in that, and I definitely concur with just the mayor, having kente cloth on and having the red, black, green, political signs, just like, oh, wow, they threw us a bone. But, a lot of people miss that.
410-319-8888, your thoughts on The Wire, this 13th anniversary of The Wire that was brought together. Some really interesting minds in the city paper in this week's issue that's still out until tomorrow when the new issue comes out that are reflected on this. And hear your ideas, 410-319-8888. Betty on line three, you're on the air.
Actually, it's really everybody on your show has just really commented on a lot of the dimensions that David Simon could have included, but I'm going to add another one. In the early 2000s, I worked in East and West Baltimore in the neighborhoods that The Wire was shot in. And, back up a little bit. I am just now watching The Wire because I had such anger about David Simon's treatment of the communities from the community leaders who were working to welcome people in recovery back into the communities, who were advocating for more drug treatment, who were trying to get the city to board up the vacant houses, to clean the trash, working to improve the schools, insisting on affordable housing. And these organizing efforts were going on in parallel with the Wire's scenes in the very neighborhoods that The Wire was being shot in, and those people were made completely invisible by David Simon. So that's another piece of the lack of historical perspective, and even just what was happening currently. So recently, Dave Zirin wrote a really cool piece.
Yes, in the Nation.
I heard it out loud when I read it because I'm like, finally, somebody is lifting up some of the young people who were organizing at the time, who were trying to improve the schools, who were learning more about media so that they could present information, who were demanding more funding for the schools. So I'll leave it at that. But the other piece is that there was some effort to get David Simon to make contributions to the neighborhood so that people could build a community center or do other kinds of projects in their communities. And if I know my history and I don't know all the dimensions, I believe that request fell on deaf ears. So that's another dimension of David Simon exploiting the communities that he worked in. So I'll leave my comment at that and take my comment. I take the hear of people's feedback off the air.
All right.
The other thing, and she talks about the representation of Baltimore and the people left out. My concern is that since The Wire aired, I believe first in 2004, we have like 9.5% of our officers that don't live in the state of Maryland. Of our police officers, they commute from Pennsylvania, they commute from Delaware. So what happens when they watch a show like this? Season one, believe episode three, the officers rough up a kid, they hurt and puncture his eye, and the residents throw objects down on the officers. And I'm wondering, to an officer who doesn't live in Baltimore, and almost 90% of our officers don't live in the city, but they see a show like this, and they're very early on, you get the notion that the community is against the police. And if that representation is shaping the way an officer might view the city, then what implications has that had for our city in terms of what we've seen in Undue Force, the series by Mark Puente, the sort of excessive force only in the past like 4 to 5 years? You know, it makes me wonder to what degree did the representation of The Wire actually go and affect policing in the city?
But are you saying that kind of intensity from the police has only happened the last 4 or 5 years?
No, I'm not saying that it's only happened in the past 4 or 5 years.
Because
but
it's clearly been...
No, not at all. But what I am saying is that I think The Wire perhaps contributed to it. I'm actually interested in looking at the data to see if there's been an incline in police excessive force. And I think there is some indication that it actually has intensified as opposed to gone down over the past, if you go back 20 years.
I mean, I would be shocked if it's more intense than it has been in the past, and that this is just not part of a continuum that continues to exist. I think that might be putting too much on The Wire.
I will say that go ahead.
I can't say as an artist that one show can have that much of an influence on an entire city. I think, you know, it just kind of reinforced the culture of violence in our city. It didn't necessarily intensify in any way.
But I think it's interesting. I think we should debate and talk about it. I mean, I like the idea, and I'd like to know more about it.
Yeah, because again, if you don't live in the city as an officer, then The Wire is your entree into the residents of Baltimore. D'Angelo and the Barksdales, like, those are the people that you think you know when you arrive on the scene. And I just think there's a danger in that.
Perhaps.
When I was moving to Baltimore, what people said to me was, oh, no, The Wire. Right? They thought that I was moving into The Wire, and their idea of, like, I shouldn't move there was this idea that these neighborhoods, and part of it, I think, is what Betty was talking about. They're represented as places of just sheer violence, right, and desperation, as if there aren't people in those communities who are actively living lives and, like, having, you know, being activists or being activists just in, like, staying there. And so those neighborhoods that, quote, look like The Wire, and this is what I wrote about in City Paper, become places that people who don't live there consider off limits, as if they cannot go there because The Wire will happen to them. And that means that whole areas of the city are sort of cut off from people transiting through them and seeing as part of the community. And that's not The Wire's fault, but it is, like, that's something that happens with when we talk about, quote, bad neighborhoods or good neighborhoods.
Let me read this piece that came in from a listener, BT, who writes in, but people are putting so much weight on this show. The show is meant to be a show, to be a text, to be entertaining and informative, not to be all-encompassing vision of Baltimore. I mean, it's complicated because David Simon is making money off of Baltimore stories. And when you look at what he did in the school season, that it was a white teacher discovering, another piece about this, a white teacher discovering the misspending of the school system that I thought that was something that the Algebra Project did. Those are two interesting thoughts there about.
Yeah. I think when I watch the show, you know, I hear people barking out drug calls in Baltimore. I see blue lights. But the show has to magnify that for the dramatic effect. So some people call this a hyper-reality. It's almost more Baltimore than Baltimore, you know, because there's too much graffiti. There's too much calling out. You know, and so the point is that it's a show that has political effects. But the point of the show is entertainment. But I'm thinking about the politics of why some people find this show so entertaining. It's because it plays on certain sort of psychological narratives of, you know, tragedy, of redemption that have serious political implications. So it's not the show that produced the narratives, but the politics of pleasure, the politics of how people view these areas is what produces policy, what produces these political realities. And that's why I think the show is so interesting. I think the show does a lot of good nuggets that produce conversations, but it's folks like me whose job it is to push those conversations into real political impact. And I think that's why we're so hard on the show, because we have want to push these conversations further than the show probably could have been expected to take them.
So the show is entertainment, but David Simon has become the go-to guy when something happens in Baltimore. Like, well, what does David Simon think? He has become a kind of political spokesperson. Right? He's a commentator, so it's not, quote, like, just entertainment. Also, the show isn't put on the air. I mean, it's put on the air to be entertainment, but also to tell deep and new kinds of stories, which David Simon absolutely does in the show, and that's why we value it. That's why we're talking about it. Right.
Go ahead, Philip.
And I think therein lies the rub, because you have to look at who is telling the story. David Simon, again, is one person. He is one person that has seen different stories, but he hasn't seen all of Baltimore. He can't tell all the stories of Baltimore. I mean, he can from the perspective of what he has done over time and the time that he has spent in Baltimore, but he hasn't walked in black shoes. He hasn't lived in Sandtown for an extended period of time and had to see the reality of his peers being run down on by the police officers. So I mean, I think, you know, it's all, I think for me, I'm hoping that in this conversation, through all that's happening to Baltimore, that art is inspired that will tell the story of Baltimore, the whole story of Baltimore, not just the wire.
Before we come back to the other Lawrence Brown, let me get the phones and read this email. And James Hanlon wrote in, if I can call in, I'll join the conversation, but let me be clear. I didn't really watch The Wire, but hated it because it only portrayed the negative side of Baltimore. Baltimore's not New York, where no matter what, it's always the greatest city in the world. This past Saturday, June the 6th, over 80 people attended a jazz concert in historic Pennsylvania Avenue, and no press came through. And no press came, although notified. The event was attended by people of all ages, economic backgrounds, and races. This is a quote from one of the attendees, who's a young professional, that attended with her husband and two young children. What an amazing afternoon Saturday. Thank you very much for creating an incredible space for the community. I left wishing there was something like that every Saturday. We had such a good time. So that lends itself to this. 410-319-8888. Lemke, you're on the air. Line one.
Hey, yeah. Look, great show.
Thank you.
Always great topics. I think that nobody looks at a Picasso and says we should put more red right here. Or we still have more blue right here. You know, like, I really don't see a difference. You know, I do understand everyone's point. I don't want to be misunderstood. Like, I understand the point of, yeah, let's talk about these things. But, I mean, that's why there are other movies. You know, you can make other movies. You can do other shows. You can do other things. But for that particular movie, I thought he did a good job for the time that he had. I mean, you can't tell every story. And I think it is art, and I don't think we should judge an artist's work after it's done like that. When we know that it's definitely good, we wouldn't be talking about it at all. Thanks.
Thank you, Lemke.
Well, Lawrence, you know, Brown. I think the one reason I'm critical of The Wire is it's not a movie. It's not a two-hour movie. You have 60 episodes. There are many opportunities in those 60-plus hours of television to tell the truth, and I think that, you know, it's not beyond reason to ask our artists to tell the truth, particularly when they do become the spokespersons for the war on drugs, or speaking out against post-industrialization, speaking out against what's happening in Baltimore. But you can't speak out about Baltimore. You can't portray art about what happens in Baltimore if you don't talk about segregation. And Douglas Massey, a sociologist, has talked about Baltimore actually being hyper-segregated. And that's one of the reasons why I think The Wire is so fascinating to people, because they never do get to see the other side of the tracks. And it's precisely because of hypersegregation that most people that live in sort of Roland Park, you know, that live in Homeland, Guilford, Northwood, Canton, they never, ever, hardly ever get to see the other side of the tracks. And I think it's actually because The Wire is so great that it poses such a danger. Its greatness in the fact that it aspires to have this reality, this sort of docudrama approach to cinematography, this docudrama approach to the narrative, to characters. It aspires to have such a gloss of reality that it can draw viewers in, and with the spellbinding performances, leave people mesmerized, but still lacking the essential truth of the situation. And I think that's why The Wire actually deserves both critique and praise, is that it is so great. I think there actually is more of a responsibility for it to have told the truth.
And the other side, let me go to the phones here and then come back to Kate and then Lawrence G. and back to Philip. And I think that, but it gets critique from all sides. I mean, one of the reasons that the industry itself never recognized The Wire, they never gave it any award, not one. not for acting, not for writing, not for anything, because they, because it opened too much from their perspective, and it did not open enough from other perspective. You know what I'm saying? To me, it was so interesting about how the kind of reaction
speaks
we have.
Volumes.
Yeah, it does speak volumes, I think, to what this particular piece did and didn't do. 410-319-8888. Mike, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Mike.
The members of your panel today.
Morning.
I was definitely compelled to tune into the show because I'm a New York transplant. I've been here for 20 years now, and I've seen Baltimore's best times, and I've seen some of the worst times as well. We all know that Baltimore is indeed a city of neighborhoods, and the knowing what types of neighborhoods to go to, that's a reality, and which neighborhoods not to go to. I started watching The Wire right after the uprising, and I thought that it was just the best time to look at that show. And what it took me back to was just my time at working at Shock Trauma. I was the lead social worker with the Violence Intervention Program.
All right.
And I was able to see a lot of my clients within those characters. And I do disagree that I know that it was some negativity there, but within those characters, I saw a lot of my clients with just the hopes and the dreams that could have been fulfilled. But because of their environment, they weren't able to reach those opportunities. So I do think that there was some positive narratives there as well. And, you know, I think that right now this conversation is definitely good. But, I mean, look how many years it was filmed. I mean, I think we're being reactive to it. And instead of talking about The Wire, how about we be proactive and look at some ways to, you know, have Baltimore looked at as a positive place to be in and want to raise our children in as well. So thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Mike. I'll let Lawrence go. I'll keep my mouth quiet for a minute.
I'll try to be succinct. I think that when people talk about West Side Development, it amazes me that sometimes they limit that to Howard Street, right? Like, we have such limited epistemic boxes about how we look at this city that some parts of Black Baltimore become this void, not just any void. Baltimore has become a symbol for an entire country of not just urban decay, but Black urban jungle. And I think The Wire, unfortunately, is a projection of a larger impulse to try to understand that in problematic ways, right? So I think that to the extent The Wire uses that artistic trope of this void upon which it can project the fears and fantasies of a larger culture onto Black Baltimore, it effaces the reality of Black Baltimore. It does not represent that reality. And we get so caught up in, especially some Black folks, our desire to feel, like, validated. Like, oh, that person looks like me and talks like me, talks like my mother, talks like my friend. That feeling in itself becomes so pleasurable that sometimes we don't see the depths of what's not there and the depths of sort of what happens when we psychologically graft our desires onto the desire just to be represented, just to be seen, heard, and loved, as opposed to wanting the conditions where we can see and hear and love ourselves. We want a national debate camp that produces national champions on the west side of Baltimore. You would never know that the Eddie Coleman Liberation Institute at Coppin is producing kids who travel to Harvard and go to Berkeley and go to Yale and do all this stuff, because that doesn't fit the narrative of Baltimore. And so we are changing that narrative. The question is, can you hear it? And sometimes I figure The Wire hurts, not helps that effort.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the images are sort of over-determining. And I think about the what Lawrence Brown was just saying about segregation. And because the drug war is the frame of it, we don't get the historical frame of where residential segregation comes from. You know, so Baltimore is the city of first. We got the first umbrella factory. We also have the first redlining law in the United States, right? So we've been a hyper-segregated city forever, right? And so how does that work? And how did urban redevelopment cut off the west side of Baltimore? I mean, when's the last time, if you aren't in West Baltimore, that you tried to ride your bike or walk or drive from central or east Baltimore to West Baltimore? It's really difficult. You know, MLK and 83 have just cut off the contact zones between holes, like areas of the city. So, yeah, David Simon can't tell all the stories, but if we're talking about what we'd want to see, what I'd want to see is a deeper historical context.
And if we're talking about solutions, I would also say, who's going to fund, you know, how will Black filmmakers get the financing to do what Simon did and tell their own version of it? You know, I think that's a part of the challenge, that in America, the financing for these type of endeavors is not cheap. And, you know, who's going to step up to the plate and say, you know what, let's fund this, you know, let's crowdsource it, or philanthropically, let's make sure this happens.
Let me try to get a couple quick calls in here before we have to go to the next subject. Line four, Andrea, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for having me on air. I wanted to thank you all for actually sharing your views with everyone that's listening right now. Lawrence, I definitely appreciate the perspective that you have to bring to the table, and I just want to make sure that we're recognizing what system that you're pointing out. You know, you were talking earlier about the role of the entertainment system, how it perpetuates what Black communities in America, particularly in Baltimore, look like, and the intentional fear that's created as a result of that. You know, these are all manifestations of white supremacy. And I just want to make sure that, we're very clear that this is what it looks like. It looks like this in Baltimore, in all sectors of the city, and it's something that I think we really, explicitly need to have conversations about, both at the policy level, at the bureaucratic level, at cultural levels, institutional levels, and interpersonal levels. You know, this kind of issue of consistent fear that is being created has been put in place, has been supported by the way that the city has been planned and consistently developed. The capital investment, the CIP, that whole process consistently perpetuates white supremacy. It is constantly upholding the division of people. And I think there is an opportunity for us as Baltimore citizens or folks that live here and are invested in the town to actually have an influence on that process. Now, it's not very transparent about how we can have an influence on that process, but I think that we need to make sure that the city government knows or recognizes that.
Andrea, I'm sorry. I apologize for breaking in. I'm terribly sorry, but we're just right up against the end of this conversation at the top of the hour, and you've had the last thought, at least on the wire for today, which we will definitely come back to because it's been a topic conversation here for a long time, and we'll continue this conversation. I think much can come out of this. I want to thank Lawrence Grand Prix from Leaders of Beautiful Struggle, Dr. Lawrence Brown from Morgan State University, Dr. Kate Trubinsky from UMBC, Philip Burgess from here at Morgan State, who also acted on the wire. I thank the four of you so much for being part of this conversation today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, man.
Well, and we're going to take a very brief break, and we'll come right back to you. Stay with us.
Forever, my darling, my love will be true, always and forever.